Paleontologists breathed new life into our understanding of dinosaurs last week. One scientist convincingly argued to relocate the nostrils on drawings of all dinosaurs. And in Madagascar, fossil hunters found rare titanosaur specimens. Titanosaurs were a large group of plant-eating dinosaurs, and the Madagascar find could provide clues about Earth's geological development. Dr. David Norman is director of Cambridge University's Sedgwick Museum. He's on sabbatical as a distinguished research fellow at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. In his Washington office with dinosaur bones resting on nearby shelves, he put this new paleontological information in perspective for us.
A new dinosaur discovered from a known part of the world might be of considerable interest. It might, for example, increase the geographic range of a particular type of species. As you probably know, the continents of the Earth have moved around on the surface of the globe, and the time when dinosaurs lived was very interesting because at the period before they first appeared on Earth, the continents of the Earth were sort of locked together into a single huge landmass called Pangaea. In the period that followed their evolution, the continents of the Earth gradually split up into the landmasses we recognize today, more or less. The population of dinosaurs primitively that lived and walked, in theory, all over the surface of the globe, because it was all dry land in one place, were rifted apart. So you can imagine them being sort of fragmented onto a series of separate island continents. Now, as soon as you isolate populations in different areas, then you raise the possibility of allowing them to evolve in isolation, and therefore evolve in different ways. So the simple discovery of a type of dinosaur in a different part of the world or in a known part of the world can be another brick in that wall of evidence that you're trying to put together to understand evolution, and evolution over a long period of time. This is a very big experiment over a very long period of time.
Do you think discoveries such as these change assumptions that scientists make? For example, the idea of nostrils of the dinosaur, I guess for years and years and years, of course, we've seen popular culture images, but they've been in one place, and scientists have assumed they've been in one place, and now they find that they're in another. Does that mean you are always rethinking certain assumptions that you have about these creatures?
You have to be careful. You can take those sorts of things too far. When you're talking about the change in position of nostrils, that's very subtle. We know where the nostrils of these dinosaurs were. It's very clear on the surface of the skull. I can point to a skull of a small dinosaur I've got here. And you know the approximate area. What's been discussed here is the precise location of the fleshy opening within a slightly larger bony rim. It's an important, subtle addition to our knowledge. It's not a sort of, wow, we didn't realize that. It's, well, that's interesting. Now, what are the biological implications if we're very precise about the positioning of the location of that particular nostril?
Are there theories you are pursuing right now?
Yeah, I'm working with a whole series of theories.
Sure. Give us an example of one with the dinosaurs that you're working. What's that question, a question you're trying to answer?
I've got a research group in Cambridge which is doing some, I think, rather interesting work. I, in the past, have worked on a number of living animals because I'm very interested in how animals work as machines. I'm really not obsessed by dinosaurs. I work on them and find it interesting, but it's not, it's just because they're dinosaurs. It's because I'm interested in how animals work. Dinosaurs present interesting problems in relation to solving the problems of life on Earth. And when you get something as improbably large as a dinosaur, then you're taking engineering principles that govern the structure of and how animals of that size work to the limits, which go beyond anything that we have living on Earth today. We can actually apply engineering principles to the construction of things like dinosaurs and then figure out how they moved, what they fed on, why they fed on certain things, why their skulls were shaped and structured the way they were. So we can get a real insight into why they were like they were and how they worked in perhaps a much more realistic framework, which is ultimately what we're trying to do.
For instance?
Some of the work that we've been doing is related to a carnivorous dinosaur called Allosaurus, which is very famous in North America, a number of skeletons of this creature. One of the questions that you ask about predators is how did they feed? I mean, it seems obvious. They just bit and then ate their prey. There have been assumptions about the way it fed. The engineering analysis that we've done has allowed us to predict, on the basis of the shape of the skull and the arrangements of the jaw muscles, how it would have fed. If you can reconstruct the jaw muscles and how many jaw muscles there were and how big they were, you can work out through a simple formula how powerful those muscles would be and how, therefore, they could close the jaw and how tight the bite was. And what we found was that the jaw muscles are wildly underpowered in the sense that the skull is 26 times more powerful than the jaw muscles. Now, that's led us then to look in detail at the skull structure, because the virtual analysis that we were doing has told us this by looking at the engineering properties of the skull, and made us realize that, in fact, these weren't animals that had a crushing bite, like T-Rex, for example, which is known to have a crushing bite, but it, in fact, was a slasher, in the sense that it slashed and teared at its prey, using its head more like a hatchet. If you imagine an animal weighing a ton or more, biting an animal that may have weighed 2 tons, 3 tons, 5 tons, imagine the forces exerted on that skull while it was banging its head against the side of the body to make a devastating wound on that animal. And therefore, the skull has to be incredibly strong. What has appeared from this research is an explanation of why the skull is built the way it is. So what we've got is a completely new insight into, you know, an engineering understanding of how these animals fed and why they fed in a particular type of way. And our analysis can now be applied to different sorts of predatory dinosaurs. And in fact, the applications are enormous within paleobiology. But now that we've developed this technique, we can use this to have a much better understanding of the why and the wherefore of the design and engineering of prehistoric creatures of all types.
Dr. David Norman is director of the Sedgwick Museum at Cambridge University. He's on sabbatical as a distinguished research fellow at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.